This is Boston Public Radio. I'm Kara Miller. This morning, the NCAA officially sanctioned the Penn State football program. And the news comes after former FBI Director Louis Freeh's scathing report placed the blame squarely on the school, including on longtime coach Joe Paterno for covering up Jerry Sandusky's child abuse. And joining me in Studio 3 to talk about this and the other news of the day are Shannon O'Brien, former Massachusetts State Treasurer, and Tom Keene, former Boston City Councilor and a regular Globe contributor. So, Shannon, I want to start with just a clip from the press conference this morning where the NCAA announced the sanction. So we're going to hear NCAA President Mark Emmer talking about the sort of risks of letting sports programs at schools get really big.
One of the grave dangers stemming from our love of sports is that the sports themselves can become too big to fail, indeed too big to even challenge. The result can be an erosion of academic values that are replaced by the value of hero worship and winning at all costs. All involved in intercollegiate athletics must be watchful that programs and individuals do not overwhelm the values of higher education. In the Penn State case, the results were perverse and unconscionable. No price the NCAA can levy will repair the grievous damage inflicted by Jerry Sandusky on his victims. However, we can make clear that the culture, actions, and inactions that allowed them to be victimized will not be tolerated in collegiate athletics.
Shannon O'Brien, what does this say about the power of sports in schools?
I don't think this is anything new. I mean, I think that the power of sports in school has been, you know, certainly significant across this country for decades. What I think needs to go even beyond this is understanding from college to college, from university to university, you know, not that I think that there's something like this child abuse that's taking place in other universities, but if that's what the ultimate goal of this is, I think they need to take even greater steps than just implementing the death penalty against Penn State.
Tom, Is this a question of sort of the tail wagging the dog where a athletic program got so powerful that it was running an academic institution?
No, well, it very well may be, but it's not clear to me that the NCAA cares really about that here. First of all, why didn't they do the death penalty? Why not shut down the program altogether for a few years, 2, 3, or 4 years, instead of a $60 million fine? That $60 million fine, by the way, represents 1 year's profit to Penn State on its football program, 1 year profit. So they're keeping the rest. I don't think that this sends a strong enough message, and it's very unpersuasive when the NCAA says, well, they don't want to do the death penalty because of the students who would be hurt. A, before they've done the death penalty and students have been hurt. B, they could have somehow taken care of those students who are currently football players, helping them to get to some other school. I don't think this sends enough a strong enough message in terms of the Sandusky issue. But then what puzzles me about the press conference is the way that the Sandusky thing is somehow linked into the culture of sports and football. Mm. I don't think they're going after that culture of sports and football at all. And that is irrelevant to the Sandusky thing.
So it is
more about how schools basically say sports matter and academics don't.
So you're saying money is still at the forefront here, even in the fine. Like, they could have gone further.
Absolutely, they could have gone further in that. I really think they should have. I really think that this doesn't send a strong enough message. It's just a fine. We get to walk away.
See, again, I think we're talking about two different things here. One is the power of money and sports in universities across the country. The other is this specific case of egregious and willful ignoring of a serious multi-year crime taking place where there were, you know, dozens, if not hundreds, of victims. One of the things, and I'm noting here that, you know, the last death penalty was Southern Methodist in 1987.
For recruiting violations.
And the thing is, there's also a little bit of, you know, when you think about recruiting violations, the violations sort of permeates the game. This is so totally separate from the game, and I think that that's where they made the distinction, because I think that most of these students and athletes who were playing on this football team, they were not involved in it. However, a recruiting scandal, the way that they actually played football, the impact on the game would have been a little bit different. Again, and that's why I sort of say it almost needs to be separated. The penalty and the egregiousness of the behavior at Penn State and what they allowed to go on, and then the bigger question, which is is, how do we look at sports? How do we look at whether or not football or those other types of intercollegiate programs are too big to analyze?
No, I think that's the interesting question. Tom kind of touched on this. Is this a sports story or is this a school administration story?
It's a school administration story, from
my perspective. So former FBI Director Louis Free, in his report, basically says that years ago, the president of the university, Joe Paterno, these people knew, and that their solution was, let's get Sandusky to move off campus, right? They knew illegal behavior.
Which is, by the way, what the Catholic Church was doing. In effect, the same thing. This was part of the culture of the time, to be frank.
So, okay, this leads to another really interesting question. Just a few days before this happened, the Joe Paterno statue, the 7-foot-tall statue on Penn State's campus, was taken down. And Maureen Dowd, in her column this weekend, asked, I think, some very interesting questions. So I'll read you a few of them. One is it right to pull down Joe Paterno's statue as though he were Saddam Hussein? And then she asked, should it be torn down, melted down, moved away from Beaver Stadium, turned to look the other way, as Joe Paterno did, or left as a reminder that coaches and athletics can be tin idols?
They have a mural on campus that apparently is an ever-changing picture of the sort of history and faces of the school. Jerry Sandusky got wiped out of it, you know, a while ago. And then Joe Paterno, they'd actually, at one point in time, it was originally painted, they actually had a halo on top of his head at one point in time. And apparently very recently, they took away the halo and they put a ribbon on his picture within this bigger mural that has one of the ribbons that's against child abuse. And so I think that last point is very interesting, is how do you make this almost a monument to this, not monument to, but a monument against this ignorance and this pain that this has caused so many families across the country.
I never particularly liked the statue anyway, so if they melt it down, that's fine by me. To a degree, taking down the statue is an effort on their part to expunge the past and not remember the past. And I do think they need to remember it. I think the other thing that we really have to ask ourselves, too, is, this fine to Penn State obviously is going to hurt Penn State, but does it even send a message to other schools? I think other schools will say, okay, yeah, in the future we're going to have to be really careful if there's allegations of child abuse. But in terms of what the NCAA is talking about, and that is that where the primacy of sports trumps now the primacy of academics, does that change at all in any other school? I don't think so.
See, I don't think it does change, and that's why I think that taking down that statue is so important, because this guy's reputation, and again, I think of a portrait of him with a halo literally on top of his head. I mean, that's how, and after all of this came out, don't forget how many hundreds of students, you know, rallied in front of his, you know, his home and his wife's home.
Absolutely.
Just before he passed away. And I think that a lot of other coaches will look at this and think, there's no child abuse going on in our program. We don't have anything to worry about. And that's why I think that this sort of muddles the issue. One, the issue is the bigness of sports and the big money of sports, and how it sort of loses the focus on academics and why are students in college. And the other is the arrogance of Sandusky and, frankly, of Paterno to think that they could get away with allowing this to continue to happen as if it really wasn't happening.
Right.
So I want to switch gears a little bit from a tragic story to another really tragic story, and this question about guns and politics, which has become sort of everything, it seems like, this weekend, at the end of last week. And let me play a little clip for you here of Mayor Bloomberg and also Mayor Menino. They did a Super Bowl ad, right? And they were both part of this group, Mayors Against Illegal Guns. Let's listen to the ad.
Giants.
Patriots.
Eli.
Brady.
We don't agree on much.
For example, the Red Sox.
Yankees.
Fiends.
Bagels.
We both support the Second Amendment.
And believe America must do more to keep guns out of the hands of criminals. You know, over 600 mayors across the country agree on common sense reforms that would save lives.
Add your voice.
Go to mayorsagainstillegalguns.org.
It's a patriotic thing to do.
You can make a giant difference in our country.
Shannon O'Brien, and we see James Holmes, the 24-year-old who's accused of killing 12 people and injuring almost 60. He had his first court appearance today. Is this a conversation about an individual incident? Is this a conversation about guns? What What do you take from what happened in Aurora, Colorado?
Well, again, I think that as with the last subject, it's many conversations. It's a conversation about mental illness. It's a conversation about how someone can get that sick with some symptoms apparently being shown to people around him. And then the other question, which I think was raised by both Mayors Menino and Bloomberg, it's the whole issue of we can support the Second Amendment. We can allow our citizens to possess arms, but do we need to have military-grade weaponry available to the vast majority of people in this country? And I think that's just crazy. And I think people, this needs to be a political issue in this campaign.
Tom Keene, we saw actually Mayor Menino issue a press release right after the horrific events in Aurora. And he says, while we still don't know much about what happened, we do know that we have laws in this country that allow people who have no business ever possessing a firearm to get their hands on guns. We have a Columbine, a Virginia Tech, a Tucson, an Aurora theater every day in America. 34 people are killed with guns every single day, and yet we will see a few weeks of media attention that forces politicians to express their condolences, but then no action is taken in Washington to fix the problem. Is he right?
So, every single time that we see a tragedy like this, and Columbine and Aurora are good examples of it, you see politicians immediately jump out of the woodwork. On the left, they say, the problem is we have to ban guns. And on the right, they start to blame, you know, it's the person or whatever.
No, they say everyone should have a gun.
Everyone
because
should
if
have,
you had
if,
a gun, you
if only
shut
the people,
back.
If only all the other theater goers had had a gun, they would have been able to shoot this guy down,
yeah.
Although he was wearing body armor. I generally am sympathetic with the argument about reducing the amount of guns that are out there, and certainly agree with Shannon in terms of why are we having, you know, assault weapons and things like that. Having said that, I find it extremely unpersuasive and probably inopportune that at this time we're talking about this issue, that as soon as something like this happens, the anti-gun lobby sort of seizes upon this as a moment to try to make something, to try to get its way, try to get some new legislation on this. I don't think that's going to happen in this case. And I guess I'm not really persuaded that in this particular circumstance, with this guy's particular problems, that any kind of legislation we would have out there really would have changed things. I mean, I don't see anyone saying, let's ban gas canisters. I don't know how he got that.
No, but I mean,
but he got that as
but
well.
But allowing the assault weapons ban to die, that I think is part of the issue. And I was watching one of the Sunday talk shows yesterday, and is it Carolyn Maloney?
Yes.
And she was very, very powerful, because the problem is this is such a politically charged issue. No one wants to talk about it. And so it takes something like this to force political leaders, you know, candidates to actually have to talk about it, because they'd all rather just kind of have their subterranean conversations with the different groups that either support them or oppose them, rather than boldly speaking about this, because it's fraught with danger on both the left and the right politically for people, especially during this emotionally charged time.
Well, look, we're not seeing it being talked about right now.
No.
Okay? This issue, from neither Democrats nor Republicans, are people saying that it's guns at this point. And I just don't see this. This incident is not going to elevate itself in any way where you're going to see a change in public policy.
And you don't feel like this is also the moment to talk about that kind of stuff.
Well, we've had many of those moments. And it turns out that there's a fundamental disagreement between gun enthusiasts and anti-gun folks. And it really does come down to, and I think I understand both sides of the argument here, but it really does come down to, you know, are we blaming the weapon, or are we blaming the individual? And ultimately, people figure that's a fruitless argument to have, so they walk away.
But if you didn't give the individual the opportunity to have multiple rounds, then, I mean, obviously, any time you have someone who's that warped, who's that sick, it's their fault. Who can get it? And again, that was one of the things. I came from Western Massachusetts. When I was a state representative, I actually had an A-minus rating from the Gun Owners Action League because I supported hunters' rights. But the reason it wasn't an A rating is because I did support, you know, bans on certain types of, you know, high efficiency weapons, assault weapons bans, here at the State House. And that, I think, does become an issue, because it's people would have you think it's yes or no, and it's not. There are regulations around the edges that could have an impact here. Not that you would stop someone from getting a gun. I don't think you're ever going to do something like that here in this country. But it's the types of weapons that are available, again, which you know, you may be right that this issue can never be resolved, but I do think that the conversation needs to take place because people politically are so afraid to talk about it. Carol Maloney said yesterday that she does not believe that this is a single issue that will defeat people, but the experience of the Congress before the one she came in, that so many people were defeated because the federal assault weapons ban was passed. And she said, hey, wait a minute, there was a bad economy. There's lots of reasons why people got defeated.
1994.
It's not that
one issue, thinks,
you know?
1994. Right. All these Democrats went down because of the assault weapons ban. Now, I have to say, Bill Bratton was on Meet the Press yesterday, and he's the former police chief in L.A., and he former police commissioner in Boston and in New York City. And he talked about gun control. And one thing he said was that, in a way, it was quite lucky that James Holmes' gun got jammed, exactly, because he could have outgunned the police. Because the initial police who responded to him, they were not a SWAT team. Like, they didn't have the kind of military-grade weapons that he had, and he would have outgunned them. Let's actually listen to Bill Bratton on Meet the Press, just sort of talking about his view on gun control.
The tragic irony of this and the continuation of these types of incidents, and they will continue, is that the outrage that's expressed against the perpetrator and the act is not then reflected in the part of the general public about wanting to do something about the instruments that are used to kill so many, the guns. All the polls I've seen recently indicate that the American population is following the political leadership, who are missing in action, most of them, on this issue, by increasingly being in favor of, if you will, relaxing of gun laws.
Tom Keene, you know, what do you do when somebody from the police side says this is a concern not just for sort of regular citizens, but for the police themselves who may respond to a crime?
No, and absolutely. And, you know, and that's what Menino and Bloomberg were also saying. I would note to you that what they're talking about, most of the times in major urban cities, though, we're not talking about legal guns. We're talking about illegal guns. They're already illegal. And somehow they're still getting into the hands of people who are shooting them. Now, it does appear that in the case of Aurora, he was able to buy those legally, or at least most of them legally, as far as I know. But the sort of daily tragedy that Menino talks about, the fact that every single day you have a Columbine or you have an Aurora, 23 gun deaths every single day, those are almost all the time with illegal guns. And so what I guess what I just find unpersuasive is this fixation upon gun control and let's make them illegal, because we make them illegal and they still get into the hands of people who want to use them.
So, Shannon O'Brien, let me give you the other side here. Here's George Will talking on ABC's This Week about what the real issue is in terms of, you know, should we be focusing on guns?
I defy you to write a gun control law that would prevent someone like this with a long time horizon and a great planning capability from getting the arms he wants. I just think this is a mistake.
We're talking about politics with Shannon O'Brien, former Massachusetts state treasurer, and Tom Keene, former Boston city councilor and a regular Globe contributor. And Shannon, what do you say when people say this is not a gun issue, this is a mental illness issue?
Well, I actually filed and passed successfully legislation that was supported by both the police officers union, the police chiefs, and the gun owners groups. And that had to do with creating a statewide registry that also basically took guns away from people who had committed a crime or who had demonstrated mental illness. I mean, that's also that's just one piece of the puzzle that has to be solved. It's not just the types of weapons that are readily available, whether they be legally or illegally gotten. Just the more of them out there, the greater the likelihood that someone or many people will be killed. But it's also, how do you create that registry of information? And that is also opposed by many of the gun owners' rights groups, which makes no sense to me whatsoever. I mean, the fact is you should have a great ability to track, but a lot of those groups also don't like that sort of registration and tracking and anything like that. So, you know, there does need to be some balance. And the problem that I find is that I think that people are naive to think that we're going to just get rid of all guns in this country. That's not going to happen. But finding ways that around the edges, whether it's with greater tracking, greater registration, greater vigilance about people who have either committed a crime or have demonstrated some mental illness, that needs to happen. I mean, I can remember in my own experience, there was a person, you know, involved in a place that I worked, and we thought this guy was a little bit crazy, and we knew he had guns, and we actually had to go to the state police. He had all of these licenses. He had committed a crime, and no one had gone to take away his guns. There needs to be a mechanism when someone does something wrong and it violates the law that you can actually follow through on that.
On the other hand, what George Will was saying in that clip sounds fairly persuasive to me. I mean, if this guy has a planning horizon of 6 months or 9 months long, and you're really hell-bent on doing this, my guess is that he would have done it notwithstanding. And that may be why this incident is not going to prompt much of a debate really over gun control or really much of a change in terms of public policy. I agree with Shannon. I mean, I don't mean to minimize it. I think that the extent that you can get rid of assault weapons, which really don't have any particular purpose for normal everyday sporting use, to the extent that you can make sure that criminals don't have them.
Right, tiny pieces of turkey.
Right, tiny pieces. You know, I mean, a lot of that can probably help on a day-to-day basis if it's coupled with real enforcement. But I don't think, to pardon the pun, I don't think it's a silver bullet here, and I'm not sure that it really would have done anything to stop the Aurora incident. Mm-hmm.
Although, you know what's interesting, and I forget where I read this, but there was a gun club that basically said, this guy is so weird.
That's right.
He can't even join.
Not even let, I mean, hello, would someone maybe have picked up the phone to the local
How about his mother, who said, mother, hearing that he was charged with this, said, I'm not surprised.
Mm. Well, I think the interesting thing about that is there was the owner of the shooting range who had called him at home. He wasn't there. He got his voicemail. And it was his voicemail that struck the guy as so odd and so disturbing that he essentially said, I don't think he should train here. I mean, this is just, it doesn't feel like a good idea. But it is hard when somebody's kind of a loner and maybe not a lot of people were calling him and hearing that voicemail. I want to bring in just one other item here that I thought was really interesting. Ty Burr in the Boston Globe wrote a very interesting piece about whether, you know, is there too much violence in media? Is that something? Because remember, this happened at the Batman movie, right? At the sort of midnight premiere, that he was very sort of keyed into going to that. And Ty Burr says, maybe it's worth having a discussion about an entertainment culture that excels at selling violent power fantasies to people who feel powerless.
I read that piece, and it was a pretty interesting piece. And the thing that he was really talking about there, which was disturbing, was this sort of fanatic fanboy element that's out there. Fanboy and fangirl, I suppose, but mostly fanboy. And it was something – and Rotten Tomatoes, which is the web aggregator site for movie reviews, actually had to shut down its comments section in advance of the movie coming out because – fanboys out there were threatening with death or rape critics who dared to criticize the movie, who's dared to not give it a perfect score. You had these death threats back and forth between fans of Avengers and fans of Batman. And there is this kind of weird cultural thing out there at a particular age group that is really disturbing here. And this guy in Aurora clearly seems to me to have reflected, in most extreme example, but clearly reflected some of what's going on there.
Yes, this kind of deep identification somehow with images in the media.
Right, that they really are. He believes he's Joker.
Yeah. I just believe it's a deeper problem within our society. I used to think that Tipper Gore, you know, was kind of, you know, just ridiculous in the fact that she wanted to label and, you know, rate records for kids that were inappropriate. And then I had a kid, you know, and then all of a sudden
I
become Tipper Gore, and I watch what, you know, my daughter watches. I listen to what she listens to, and I have to censor her. But it's hard as a parent, you know, whether it's a 15 or 16 year old boy, especially, you know, or an 11 or 12 year old girl. It's just everything in the media right now is a little bit troubling when it comes to sort of rational and common sense living, if you will.
We're talking politics with Shannon O'Brien and Tom Keene on Boston Public Radio. Shannon, was it right for both Romney and Obama to really step back their rhetoric and I think to a large degree suspend their campaign ads in Colorado?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that, you know, I think that they would have been criticized roundly if they'd done anything other than that. But I think that the bigger question is you've had this silence from the campaigns and sort of getting us back to the original. Are they going to start talking about something like this? Will they actually actually, you know, because Obama, you know, whom I support, became very, I forget if it was at the convention, but he talked about, you know, weapons like this getting into the hands of the general public. Mitt Romney signed an assault weapons ban here in Massachusetts when, you know, when he was governor. So, but he's obviously changed his position on that. But what do they say in response to some of these very pointed questions about that whole issue? I think they should end their silence by speaking about this.
Yeah, just on the silencing of the commercials. I think Shannon actually notes, though, that it was not necessarily out of respect for what happened, but out of the fact that they knew that if they continued to run the commercials, they'd get criticized for it. So even shutting those down was a political
act. Yeah, I mean, I'll give them both credit for you know, for respect. I mean, frankly, Obama, you know, had to go, yay, you know, one more day that we don't talk about the economy. So, you know, that probably benefits him a little bit more.
I'm sure that Romney felt the same about Bain and his tax returns.
Yeah, exactly. But, I mean, I wouldn't say that there was in some respect, but certainly I think that if they tried to do that. But again, this was what happened. I remember after 9/11, I remembered the Saturday Night Live, and I remember Rudy Giuliani going on Saturday Night Live, and they said to him, is it okay for us to be funny again? He goes, why start now? But that was, I mean, remember, after 9/11, which was obviously a tragedy of, you know, far, you know, greater proportions than this, it was hard for a lot of different people in the public, you know, whether it's the media, whether it was comedians, whether it was our politicians. How do you sort of express yourself when this huge tragedy has happened?
So let's talk about the campaign, the sort of national presidential campaign as a whole. You know, there's been some very interesting commentary in the last few days that this is a campaign about very little, that it's sort of a campaign. It's all ad hominem attacks, like how bad is Bain Capital? And
that's
and,
right, because they're people, too.
That's right. They are. Exactly. And so I'm wondering, Tom Keene, when you look at the campaign, does this feel like a huge campaign and a huge amount of money about nothing?
So at this point, I think we're too early. And the campaigns like this really don't get into gear until the summer ends. And I think at that point, and I actually really do expect at that point that the campaigns will become significantly more engaged in issues because we'll have debates between the candidates and there really is going to be some kind of discussion about where we're going at this point. Early on in campaigns, a lot of it is trying to either define oneself positively as sort of a good guy, if you will, a good woman, or define the other candidate as a bad person. And I think that's really what we're seeing right now. You know, these negative attacks, you know, it's debatable at this point whether they're working either way. But eventually, I really do expect that you're going to see a campaign that's going to be largely focused on the economy and that both sides are really going to have to engage in that one.
And Shannon, it feels like a ton of money is being spent. I mean, this is going to be the most expensive presidential campaign ever, well over $1 billion. And you look at the polls and it's like Obama 47, Romney 46. These are the three most recent polls. That was Rasmussen, Gallup, Obama 48, Romney 44, New York Times, CBS, Romney 47, Obama 46. It feels like a ton of money being spent to change like a few votes.
There's three people in America that we're actually talking
right.
to. Imagine how much it's going to be. You know, I think that, you know, I agree with Tom. Right now, it's a very interesting time because Romney is limited in terms of the finances that he can actually spend directly from the campaign. And he's been a little bit back on his heels because the Obama people have been taking that financial and sort of legal advantage to basically, you know, point their guns at him and really define him before he actually has free access to the money from his own campaign. But I'm not surprised at this. I think that, you know, in any campaign, you're going to be doing your best to define the other side. And I agree with Tom. I think that once the fall comes, that they're actually going to have to be showing those differences. But I will tell you, the negative campaign ads are not going to stop. And I forget what ad, you know, expert, you know, political consultant said, you're going to want to poke your eyes out, you know, by October 1st, because you're just not going to want to turn on your television.
Now, whether they work is a really open question. I mean, I know that every campaign believes that negative ads work, but I'm not persuaded beyond a certain level that they really do. They can raise questions. I mean, I think that happened very clearly during the whole Republican primary process where negative ads actually just really raised questions, such as the negative ads about Gingrich really pointed out his real problems. I mean, in a sense, they were accurate ads, I think, even though negative. But whether you know, whether at the point that we're poking our eyes out, that's actually changing our vote. I'm not sure it's changing our vote at that point.
No, but I think that I saw this in my own race against Mitt Romney. I actually had, you know, pretty fairly high positives, you know, going into the final election, and you know, my numbers were beaten down pretty hard. It wasn't so much on the Democratic side, but Romney actually began running negative ads against me before I even was the Democratic nominee, and that had an impact. You know, so it does have an impact, but then it's those last four people who are going to decide, and hopefully they're going to decide on the issues and the differences between the two campaigns. I think that you're going to see the debates are going to be incredibly highly watched. I think they're going to be, I won't say entertaining, but very interesting to the people of this country. I think that they're going to be a very, very good opportunity for us to see the stark political differences.
They're likely going to get huge audiences, probably over 50 million people. So these could be game changers. Yeah.
And to add to that, I mean, I think what we have here is two very intelligent men who really do understand what's going on, two very accomplished men. And I think in the debates, what you will have is a high reluctance on the part of either to start attacking, because it diminishes the attacker to do that. And as a consequence, I think it really will be a somewhat elevated debate.
You know, let me, Shannon, you mentioned going back to Massachusetts here. Massachusetts is really going to factor into this campaign in probably ways we haven't even seen yet. Although in the last few days, we've seen Bay Windows, a local newspaper, accusing Romney of changing his stance, essentially, on his support of gay rights.
Wait,
since
Romney is changing his position on something?
Since 1994.
When does this happen,
so
Kara?
Are you
shaken, Tom?
I have my whole faith in the system.
Does this have the potential to really hurt Romney? And maybe even in Republican circles, where they're not that... They don't have that good a sense of where he stood in 1994.
Well, you know, I think that's part of what the Republican race did for Romney is really begin to point out to people the sort of flip flop issue that hurt. You know, has hurt him, and I think has hurt him personally as a candidate. You know, I'm not sure if this is one, but it's, we know him, we've been apart here, we've seen that flip-flop, and it's, you have to have a president that ultimately there's some core there. I would think that there are a lot of people who voted for George Bush, not that they necessarily agreed with him 100% in terms of all the issues that he said he supported when he was running for president against John Kerry or Al Gore, but I think the people felt that there was a core there that, you know what, I may not agree with him, but he stands for something. That's really important to the people in this country, is to have someone who has a core to stand for something. And I think that, you know, that is just one piece that will paint that picture of Romney as
a candidate.
Right,
I think that's right. I mean, the classic person with a core really was Ronald Reagan. Many people voted for him, but at least they felt he stood and believed in something. And many people really did not even support his positions.
Or understand, you know, that he passed one of the biggest tax increases in the history of the country.
I think that it's exactly right with Romney. I mean, the guy, whether you want to say he has no core or just that he's the ultimate pragmatist, he decided he wanted to win the Republican primary. And in order to do that, he has to kowtow to the social conservatives. And he went out and did so. And so he has changed his position on, it's not just on gay and lesbian issues, by the way. I mean, it's on
choice,
everything.
Choice, health care,
his number
weapons.
One accomplishment as a governor. Yeah. Was the health care law in Massachusetts, which he has essentially had to deny.
That'll be an interesting part of the debates, yeah. I think, when Obama and Romney get to engage that. Let's talk about one person. You touched on this person, Shannon O'Brien, who is not probably going to be a part of the Romney campaign. Here is former President George W. Bush being interviewed on Morning Joe last Wednesday.
I really don't want to be in the public eye anymore and feel a certain sense of liberation not being out there.
You like it better.
I really do. I mean, look, 8 years was awesome. And, you know, I was famous and I was powerful. But I have no desire for fame and power anymore.
Shannon, is this going to hurt Mitt Romney that George W. Bush is not willing to? It sounds like he's not willing to go out and campaign for him. Like, he supports him, but at home.
He obviously, his numbers nationally are still, you know, not very good. And I think the majority of people in this country still blame him for the economic recession right now. Although, you know, obviously Obama, as he is in office longer, he owns more of that. I think, I don't know if you saw, there was an ad, there was a thing on, I think it was Conan O'Brien, where they showed a piece of this interview, and he was saying, you know, this dirty campaigning is happening already. And so the clip was George Bush saying, I support Mitt Romney, and then immediately you see paid for by the Obama committee. You know what I mean? Just him saying that he endorsed him was obviously dirty tricks, you know, negative campaigning. So I think he's going to lay low. I think that perhaps for his own legacy, he does not want to become part of this campaign. I think it might be kind of tough for him and for his, you know, his father, who is not, you know, doing all that well, you know, health-wise right now. I think he wants to lay low, do what he can. He'll probably help him raise some money, but staying out helps him and helps Romney as well.
Yeah, I think Shannon's exactly right on this one. There's no, I mean, George W. Bush may be, you know, tired of fame and power, you know, sort of the been there, done there thing. No. You know, been there, done that. But I really think he's been also told, you know, we really don't want you getting involved in this. There is also a tradition of some degree of respect that the former president gives to the next president. And I think that factors into this, too.
One final question for you guys. You know, we talk about these sort of high-profile endorsements. It's possible there has been discussion in the last few days that Elizabeth Warren may be the keynote primetime speaker at the Democratic National Convention. This is coinciding with the fact that she is now one of the top 15 Senate fundraisers of all time. I mean, she's not just drawn in money from Massachusetts, but from all over the place. What does it do for Elizabeth Warren, Janet O'Brien, if she becomes the keynote speaker chosen by President Obama and she gets that kind of platform?
Oh, I think it's huge. I mean, obviously she'll dominate the news here in Massachusetts for you know, for week before, week after. I mean, I think it's a great thing for her. I think it'll be interesting to see. Maybe she can actually get that quote right rather than how Obama did it, saying, you know, you didn't get here by yourself. Hopefully she can actually set the record straight about what she actually said, what she meant, and what Obama said and what he meant about that.
Should she be picked, Tom Keene?
Well, I mean, it's obviously going to help her campaign. And so it's a brilliant campaign strategy. Whether this sells the rest of America on Barack Obama, I don't know.
It'll be an interesting thing to see. I wonder if this will increase pressure on Mitt Romney to put Scott Brown front and center.
No. What she's there for is to talk about the corporate raiders on Wall Street. She is going to be the face of what's wrong with those corporate raiders, reminding you where Mitt Romney came from.
That's going to do it for us today for Politics as Usual. We have been talking with former Massachusetts Treasurer Shannon O'Brien and former Boston City Councilor Tom Keene. Thanks so much to both of you.
Pleasure.
Thanks.
And we've got Callie Crossley back in Studio 3. And I hear the music coming up from the control room here, which can mean, of course, only one thing, the Olympics.
That's right, Kara. Marketplace's Tess Viglin calculates the cost of going for the gold. We'll look at the financial sacrifices Olympic athletes make.
And I'm guessing these are sacrifices that for most of us, we probably just would never want to make.
Exactly. Tess Viglin will reveal what these athletes are putting on the line in a different way. I'm Kathleen Crossley. You're listening to Boston Public Radio.